We'd like to think we make conscious, well-informed decisions. We know exactly why we voted for one presidential candidate over the other, and we know why we invested in one stock over others. But science writer Shankar Vedantam says our actions are often dictated by unconscious biases in our brains, and we then spend a lot of time rationalizing our actions. His new book's called The Hidden Brain: How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Precedents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. He joins me in the studio now. Shankar Vedantam, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write that some of the tasks performed by our hidden brains are things we've learned over time till they become second nature to us. For example, thanks to my hidden brain, I now know that I'm sitting on a chair in the World Studio without consciously thinking about it, while the conscious part of my brain is focusing on my conversation with you. So in other words, my hidden brain's helping me multitask.
Your hidden brain helps you multitask. Your hidden brain allows you to speak language without having to think about what words you're going to be using. Your hidden brain knows that you need to make eye contact when you talk to me. And it does all these things because in everyday life, these things are very important to do. And yet our conscious minds can focus on things that are important, on the content of our conversations and on the ideas.
And yet a great part of your book is about cases when things go wrong with letting so many of our actions be controlled by our unconscious minds. We can make snap judgments about people and situations when we should ideally be making conscious, objective decisions.
So the analogy that I often use is that the hidden brain is like the autopilot function on a plane, and the conscious brain is like the actual pilot of a plane. There's nothing wrong with having an autopilot function, and in fact, having an autopilot is very useful through much of our lives. But when we are flying through a thunderstorm, you don't want to be flying on autopilot. You want to be flying consciously. The problem with the hidden brain is that it helps us in much of our everyday lives, and it becomes a crutch. And often when we are making judgments that require conscious attention and deliberation, the hidden brain takes over and makes these automatic, unthinking, dumb decisions that we end up paying a price for.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, politics turns out to be a very good example of that. Before the 2008 presidential campaign, for example, psychologists conducted an experiment that showed that at an unconscious level, voters were more likely to see Barack Obama as being less American than Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister. What's astonishing about this is that if you ask the voters at a conscious level, they would tell you, well, of course, Tony Blair is, you know, British Prime Minister and Barack Obama is a U.S. citizen. But at an unconscious level, people had an association between someone who was white-skinned and somebody who was dark-skinned. And the unconscious association was white skin equals American, dark skin equals non-American. And the reason this is significant is that people who at an unconscious level saw Barack Obama as not being fully American were less likely to support him in both the Democratic primary and the general election, even when they agreed with him on all of the policy issues.
So it's our unconscious minds or hidden brains that actually gives us sort of racial biases or even biases between sexes.
So I think bias can happen at both a conscious and an unconscious level. There are people who hold conscious biases against people of color, against women, against minorities of various kinds. But it's my argument and the contention of the hidden brain that it's the unconscious biases that matter a lot more. So if you look at the 2008 presidential campaign again, there were numerous commentators who said overtly sexist things about Hillary Clinton when she was running in the Democratic primary. And there was a lot of attention paid to those sexist comments. And I think many of those sexist comments arose from conscious sexism. People didn't want to see, you know, a female candidate running for president. But I think what was more significant and that we didn't discuss at all was the unconscious sexism of millions of voters who may have chosen not to vote for Hillary Clinton, thinking they were disagreeing with her on policy issues, when actually at an unconscious level, they were uncomfortable with the fact that she was a woman.
Now, is one of the main reasons for you writing this book is that we ought to understand our unconscious minds and hidden brains a little bit better so we can make conscious decisions instead of letting our hidden brains take over?
I think that's exactly what I'm trying to say. It's not the contention of this book that we should always do everything consciously. I'm not necessarily saying that our conscious mind needs to run every minute aspect of our lives. In fact, that would be paralyzing if we were to do that. But I am saying that when it comes to important judgments, when we are a member of a jury and we're deciding whether to sentence somebody to death, when we are making a decision about whom to elect in a presidential election, when we're deciding which candidate to hire for a job, those decisions should be made consciously, entirely consciously, and not unconsciously.
But if our hidden brains are exerting such subtle influences on us and we are unaware of them, how do you go about countering that effect?
That's an excellent question. So if you went back to the politics question, the way I think we would go about this is, before you start evaluating the candidates, draw up a list of what issues you care about. Draw up a list of your policy preferences and say, I would like a presidential candidate who meets these policy requirements. And then evaluate the candidates on their policy issues and say, which of these candidates meets my policy requirements? And use that as your starting point rather than saying, I have a gut feeling about this candidate, I have a gut feeling about that candidate.
Now, going back to another popular book about how our minds work, Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, one of the points he was making in the book that we should trust our instincts. And you're essentially saying somewhat the opposite. Is there a balance here? And how do we set that balance? Letting ourselves go with our instinct and not letting our instincts take over?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Malcolm Gladwell's, and I really enjoy his reading greatly. But I do think that the central contention in The Hidden Brain is at odds with the central contention in Blink. I am making the argument that our intuitions, especially in situations where we're making judgments about other people, other people's lives, other people's well-beings, our intuitions are not reliable guides. I think Gladwell tried to make the point at Blink that when you do something consciously, repeatedly, over very long periods of time, you can develop the kind of expertise that would then allow you to make intuitive decisions that are very skillful. And I have no disagreement with Malcolm on that. Where I do disagree with him is the sense that on an everyday level, most of our intuitive decisions are accurate and based on, you know, good judgment. Much of the time, they're based on these knee-jerk, unconscious associations. And there are several small warehouses of research studies, I think, that show that relying on human intuition is a really problematic idea.
One of the major roles of our hidden brains that you talk about in the book is its role in helping us navigate our social interactions, figuring out who we should trust, we shouldn't, and how we behave within groups. And of course, these things are important in our daily lives. But one example that you use in your book is how our hidden brains influence our behavior in disaster situations. You write about 9/11 and how unconscious behaviors control people's reaction on two floors of the South Tower of the World Trade Center and ultimately determined who died and who survived. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So the South Tower of the World Trade Center was the second tower to be hit that awful morning. There was a 16-minute window between the time the first plane crashed into the North Tower and the time the second plane hit the South Tower. Now, obviously, people in the South Tower didn't know that a second plane was coming, and so people within the tower had to make a decision about whether to leave the building or to stay where they were. And there was real disagreement about this because several years earlier, when a bomb had been set off at the World Trade Center, I believe it was 1993, there was a lot of confusion and people got stuck in elevators and on the stairs trying to exit the towers. And the evolving idea in disaster management was, if your own building is not damaged, then it makes sense to stay in the building and not exit where you could get hit. What I try and show in this chapter is that a financial trading firm that was spread over two floors high up in the World Trade Center in the South Tower on the 88th and 89th floor, everyone on the 88th floor made the decision to leave the building and eventually survived. And nearly everyone on the 89th floor decided to stay behind in the building and eventually perished.
The reason the people on the 88th floor survived was because of one individual who essentially ran through the corridor and asked them to leave.
Yeah, so there was, I think, sort of an avalanche effect where one person jumped up, screamed at everyone to leave. There was a mad rush for the doors, and it sort of triggered this vast and quick movement. Almost everyone on the 88th floor who left the floor left within a couple of minutes of the plane hitting the North Tower. And you often find this in disaster situations, how people behave in the first couple of minutes often ends up being decisive, partly because your window, your ability to respond, is actually pretty limited. That if people hadn't responded within the first couple of minutes, their odds of making it down 88 flights of stairs were severely limited. And the point that I was trying to make with the chapter was not so much that one group made the right decision and the other group made the wrong decision. We know that only in hindsight. What I'm trying to make is the argument that in disaster situations, our sense of autonomy, that we often feel that we are making decisions autonomously and intentionally, disaster situations deprive us of that sense of autonomy even more powerfully than everyday situations. The behavior of our groups, the people around us, become far more decisive when a fire alarm goes off in our building. And you can see this in your everyday life. When you're sitting in a workplace and the smoke alarm goes off, people will turn to one another. People will turn to the person sitting in the cubicle next to them and say, "Do you think it's a false alarm?" And at a conscious level, it's absurd to ask the person sitting next to you whether he or she thinks
because
it's a false alarm.
Because they have exactly the same amount of information that you do.
They know nothing more than you do. But the desire to form a consensus, especially in a crisis, is something that's really hardwired into the hidden brain. And one of the things I'm trying to do with that chapter is to tell people, especially in disaster situations, be aware that your sense of autonomy is severely curtailed by the people around you. And they can sometimes lead you to good places and they can sometimes lead you to bad places. But what's really important is to recognize that you are not making judgments autonomously and intentionally, even though you feel you are.
Now, on a related topic, another chapter of your book talks about terrorism, and I was particularly fascinated by how our hidden brains influence, you know, whether someone becomes a terrorist and a suicide bomber. And we think of terrorists as extremists, people who've, you know, consciously chosen to terrorize or kill because of religious extremism or whatever other extremist viewpoints that they may have. But you write that suicide bombers are perfectly normal people and they appear to be intelligent and thoughtful.
There's been a lot of interesting research conducted among suicide bombers who have failed to complete their missions and are now in prisons of various kinds around the world, many of them in Israel. And these interviews and these psychological evaluations of these people show that, if anything, suicide bombers tend to have better mental health than the rest of us. They tend to be more idealistic than the rest of us. They're often not crazed religious nuts, as we usually think. They're also not necessarily people who themselves have suffered great acts of humiliation and are acting out these narratives of revenge. And in fact, if we were to look at the evidence, it's actually pretty clear that this is the case. So if you look at the perpetrators of the 9/11 attack or the Christmas Day bomber, many of them are coming from extremely privileged backgrounds. And if we were to take a longer view of the phenomenon of suicide terrorism, if we were to look, for example, at the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers in the 1980s in Sri Lanka, you would find that religion actually was not a big factor at all in the decision of Sri Lankan, these Tamil Tigers, to adopt suicide terrorism as a weapon. And so our belief that religious fundamentalism is a necessary or sufficient condition for suicide terrorism turns out really to be flawed. And even if you look at the Middle East, many of the groups that have carried out suicide terrorist attacks turn out to be secular groups, and many suicide bombers turn out to be atheists. And so our intuitions about what makes a suicide bomber, to go back to our earlier conversation about intuitions, turns out to be systematically false. It isn't the case that suicide bombers come from personal histories of humiliation. It isn't the case that they come necessarily from personal backgrounds of degradation. It isn't necessarily the case that they're religious fundamentalists. What I try and show in this chapter is it's not so much the personality characteristics of the individuals that's decisive, but the environmental characteristics of the groups that they come from that tend to be decisive. So it's the psychology of what I call small groups, the small group dynamics that really are decisive, whether you're talking about the Japanese kamikaze bombers, whether you're talking about the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers, whether you're talking about the young men and women who are volunteering for suicide terrorist attacks in Iraq and Afghanistan today.
I mean, you write about how our hidden brains control our behavior in small groups, how manipulating that really turns people into suicide bombers. Could you tell us a little bit more about that process? You talk about the tunnel where they are manipulated.
So the chapter where I talk about suicide terrorism is called The Tunnel. And what I'm trying to show in that chapter is that what's common to suicide bombers across the world is that they almost invariably come out of these situations where they're speaking, hearing, thinking, all within a very small, constrained set of ideas. They're either physically constrained from other people, or their circumstances prompt them to be surrounded by others who are exactly like themselves. They're not hearing contrary points of view. One of the things that I think is decisive is that human beings are powerfully influenced by the small groups that are around them. And you can take a small group of journalists or a small group of investment bankers or a small group of basketball stars, and you will find that in each of these small universes, the groups develop norms that are often very different from the norms of the outside world.
So peer pressure is very powerful.
Yeah, but it's peer pressure of a very intense kind. It's not peer pressure of sort of the generalized kind of everyone wants to do well. But for an investment banker at some level, it's not so much the money at the end of the day that really is the motivating force. It's that the norms of being an investment banker have changed that individual. And so even if the person makes $1 million in the first year, it's not as if the person now says, I don't need to make any more money. Because really it's the game that's being played with all the other investment bankers, and the norm is you try and make as much money as possible. And I argue that the same phenomenon is happening whether you're talking about missionaries going into harm's way for a very idealistic cause or for suicide terrorists, that what you have is small groups of people who are intensely loyal to one another. And when you have that, you set the stage for manipulators or people, leaders in these groups, to change norms of human behavior.
Now, do these leaders really understand the workings of our hidden brains better than most of us? Is that why they're able to manipulate the rest?
I don't know whether they do it consciously or not. I think it certainly is the case that many of the leaders of these groups are very skilled at manipulating people at an unconscious level. I don't know whether they are doing it at a conscious level or they themselves are doing it at an unconscious level. But I think it is the case that these leaders are very skilled at upturning the norms of human behavior. And so within the tunnel, that is the suicide bomber's tunnel, becoming a suicide terrorist is not aberrational. It becomes aspirational. And when you turn the norm so that suicide terrorism is not aberrational but aspirational, you no longer have to go out and recruit people to come to you.
So you feel privileged to be
here. You feel privileged to be a suicide bomber. So within the world of, for example, Islamic suicide terrorists today, you know, becoming a suicide terrorist is not to be, you know, someone who is looked down upon as, you know, the dregs of society. It's to become the rock star. And so you've upturned the norms of human behavior, and within the tunnel, what's up becomes down and what's down becomes up.
Now, let's talk about the other end of a terrorist attack for people who've experienced or people who are part of a community or a country that's experienced at some point of time a terrorist attack. There's some interesting research about how if someone belongs to a group that has experienced a terrorist attack, it changes their unconscious attitudes toward this the group that's terrorizing them. And could you talk a little bit about how that influences our decision-making and our policies?
So in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, researchers asked Americans how likely they were to be personally affected or killed by terrorism. And the number of Americans who felt personally at risk was so large that for that fear to materialize, there would have had to have been a 9/11 attack every single day in the United States. So in terms of our fears were so disproportional to the horror of what happened that we vastly overestimated the risks to our own lives. And we didn't do that because we were deliberately, you know, miscalculating the risks. We did it because our hidden brains prompt us to be hyper-vigilant to external threats. There was also very interesting research that shows that when you remind people about these very traumatic events, it changes how they think about how their own group should respond. So when you remind Americans about the 9/11 attacks, for example, and then place before them a list of policy options in Iraq or Afghanistan, they're unconsciously biased to choose a different set of policy options than if you hadn't reminded them about 9/11.
And what kinds of policies are they more likely to pick?
Well, when you feel that your group has been attacked or humiliated or somehow traumatized in some way, you're likely to respond in ways that say, we need to protect our group, we need to defend our group, we need to do whatever we can to make sure this attack against our group doesn't happen again. What's really interesting to me about this research is that you don't need to remind Americans about 9/11 for them to react in particular ways to Iraq and Afghanistan. You could remind them about what happened in Pearl Harbor 60 years ago. And everyone would agree that what happened in Pearl Harbor should have absolutely nothing to do with policy options in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And still it does.
And still it does. And the reason it's happening is that at an unconscious level, being reminded of trauma changes the way we think about our current day policy issues. And this is true whether you're you're in Israel and Palestine, whether you're in India and Pakistan, whether you're in the United States thinking about Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's one of the ways our hidden brain changes how we think about war and foreign policy.
Now, so, you know, everything that we've talked about today has been about how our unconscious minds have pretty profound effects on our lives and decisions that we make. But a lot of these effects are subtle. How do researchers get at such subtle effects when the people that you're working with are mostly unaware of what's going on?
Well, for the researchers, it's pretty simple, because what you really have to do is just bring a bunch of volunteers in and ask them what they think the policy options are in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then you remind the volunteers about what happened at Pearl Harbor and ask them to make the very same decisions, and they reach different decisions.
But what about sort of the neurological underpinnings of these processes?
Yeah, I think there has been some work using neuroimaging, thinking about how the hidden brain works. But I think in many ways, the more important work has come out of social psychology, out of sociology, out of the less hard social sciences, if you will. There has been some work looking at neuroimaging that shows in some ways that there are parts of our brains that we have no idea about that play a really decisive effect when it comes to morality or honesty or whether we think of ourselves as being good people.
In recent years, we've seen a number of popular books about how our minds work. Last year on our science forum, we spoke with a science reporter named Jonah Lehrer about his book, How We Decide. And of course, another book that we talked about earlier was Malcolm Gladwell's Blink. Do you think there's a growing sort of public demand for books like yours and these other books? Or do you think there's more research now and therefore more understanding? That's why we're seeing this, these books.
I think possibly both. I think what struck me as I was reporting the book is that if you look at almost every institution in our society, from the way we think about the criminal justice system to our politics to the way hospitals work and the medical system works, there is an underlying assumption across the board that human beings act in conscious, autonomous, and intentional ways. And over the last 10 years, there have really been these mountains of research studies that have shown that this is really not the case. And it's posing very difficult questions to the way we think about these institutions in our society. So if we are influenced by the unconscious when we are jurors, how should we change the criminal justice system? If we are making errors as eyewitnesses to crimes, depending on whether the person we're identifying belongs to our race or a different race, how should we change the way eyewitness identifications are done? The law has not begun to grapple with these issues, just as politics and medical systems have not begun to grapple with these issues. So in many ways, I think the underlying motivation for me was the fact that I think there is this huge gap between what science is showing about human behavior and the way we think about human behavior in the policy sphere.
Shankar Vedantam, we'll have to leave it there, but our listeners will have a chance to continue this conversation with you online on the World Science Forum, which goes through next Friday, March 5th. Do you have any questions for our listeners, any experience that you want them to share with you on the World Science Forum?
Well, one of the things in the book that I found very intriguing and very troubling is the association that has been found between unconscious racial bias and political views. There is research showing that the higher the level of your unconscious racial bias, the more likely you are to vote conservative. And the less racial bias you have at an unconscious level, the more likely you are to vote for Democrats. And I'm curious what our listeners think about this. Do they feel that unconscious racial biases are influencing their political attitudes? When you think about the Tea Party movement, for example, how much of it is about the policy disagreements that the Tea Party movement has produced? How much of it has to do with unconscious racial bias about, for example, the first biracial president that we have? How do we grapple with these issues? How do your listeners think about them?
You know, I'm wondering if any of our listeners have had an experience of where they've voted, come back, and then gone, oh, shoot, I should have thought more about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in many ways, not making these decisions consciously can come back and bite us, because we vote for people based on whether we like them, whether they look right for the job, whether we think they're quote-unquote one of us. And then they turn out to be president, and they're president for 4 years, and we have to live with them after the fact, and we have to live with their policy decisions.
Shankar Vedantam, author of the new book, Hidden Brain, thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much for having me.